This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says the U.S. and some European countries were overly involved in the recent riots that were aimed at destroying the country's strong points. Brazilian police retake control of key governmental buildings, including the Congress, after they were overrun by supporters of Jair Bolsonaro. And a new survey shows around 75% of German companies expect business to shrink or stagnate this year. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran's Islamic Revolution leader says foreign enemies were overly involved in the recent riots in the country. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the United States and European countries openly fueled the riots one way or another. The leader added that they pushed their involvement mainly through propaganda in cyberspace as well as on Western and other media. He said the media hype was aimed at creating the impression that the rioters were discontent with economic problems and shortcomings in the economic and other sectors of the country. The leader noted, however, that they did not want weaknesses to go away. The aim, he said, was rather taking out the country's strong points. Ayatollah Khamenei underlined that the rioters did amount to treason. He urged relevant bodies and officials to seriously deal with any act of betrayal. Tehran has once again censured controversial French weekly Charlie Hebdo for publishing cartoons of the religious and political authorities of Iran, as well as a clear example of preaching hate and inciting violence. The foreign ministry spokesman says the cartoons insult Muslim sanctities and Iran's religious and national values. Nasser Kanani says the caricatures are also an insult to women and published in a country that claims to be a champion of their rights. The spokesman is also expressing regret that the French government has supported the cartoons rather than dissociating itself from the move. Iranians have held rallies in different parts of the country over the past days to protest this move. The foreign ministry has also summoned the French ambassador to protest the caricatures while closing the French cultural center in Iran. We asked political commentator Fahd Izadi why Charlie Hebdo easily insults other faiths despite the existence of hate speech laws in France.
In France, we have hate speech laws in the books, and what the French government could do is just easily invoke those laws, prosecute the magazine. That's what they should do. What they do in practice is give the French government gives this magazine financial support. They gave the magazine 1 million euros in 2015. And the current French president, Macron, has been supporting the magazine. And this is also not something that's required from the French president. We remember previous French officials that used to criticize the behavior of this magazine. And in fact, the French government has banned the magazine 3 times in its history for violating hate speech laws. So what we see is basically the French engaging in hybrid warfare against Iran using the magazine.
An official ceremony has been organized in Damascus to mark the third assassination anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. He was commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Muhammad Ali reports from Syria.
Syrian, Iranian, Palestinian, and Yemeni officials have gathered in Damascus to pay tribute to the commander of Iran's Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's ambassador to Syria said the ceremony is aimed at renewing allegiance to the thoughts of General Soleimani, who foiled Western plots in the region.
What humiliated the U.S. in Western Asia was Iran and the Resistance Alliance. General Soleimani played a great role in foiling U.S. plots and changing the balance of power in the interest of the people of the region. Iran's regional power in West Asia in the past two decades was a result of Soleimani's strategic thinking.
We express our gratitude to a man who considers Syria a priority and worked for a bright future for the people of the region based on cooperation. Syria will not forget this man, and his life will inspire all those who want the best for their nations.
Soleimani's sacrifices and heroism will remain alive in the memory of Syrians and free people of the world. His path will inspire many generations to come.
Speakers recall General Soleimani's significant efforts in countering the plots of Western powers and their proxies in the region, primarily his role in supporting Palestinian resistance against the Israeli enemy.
General Soleimani had a great role in supporting Palestinian resistance factions, but in providing arms and training or planning in the face of Israeli aggression. He supported our people in repelling all Israeli attacks in 2008, 2009, 2012, and 2014.
Anthems praising the resistance and General Soleimani were chanted during the event. The ceremony also included an exhibition showcasing various stages of General Soleimani's life, quotes, and battles against terrorism. For over a week, Syrians organized many events to commemorate General Soleimani's achievements in Syria, in a show of respect to a commander who stood beside them during their hardships and played a key role in eliminating terrorism almost in every inch of Syria's territory. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
The Palestinian Prisoner Society says 233 Palestinian inmates have lost their lives in Israeli jails since the occupation of the West Bank and East al-Quds in 1967. The rights group says scores of the prisoners died due to medical negligence. The rest were either killed under torture or were shot dead. In addition, hundreds of Palestinian detainees lost their lives due to health issues after being freed from the regime's prisons. Currently, Israeli jails hold about 4,700 prisoners. 150 children are among them. Many of the inmates are in poor health, worsened by medical negligence. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, Israel has suspended the VIP pass of Palestinian Foreign Minister Raed al-Maliki that could hinder his travel in and around the occupied West Bank. That is in response to the Palestinians' bid to involve the International Court of Justice in their conflict with the Israeli regime. Israeli forces confiscated al-Maliki's card while he was entering from Jordan. Israel's new right-wing cabinet has announced a series of measures after the UN General Assembly responding to Palestinian appeal that asked the ICJ for an opinion on the legal status of Israel's occupation of Palestine. The regime's measures include using Palestinian money to compensate Israelis killed or injured in Palestinian operations. It has also imposed a moratorium on Palestinian constructions. Separately, an Israeli minister who recently stormed into Al-Aqsa Mosque has directed troops to remove Palestinian flags from public spaces, and that after a long-serving Palestinian prisoner waved a flag receiving a hero's welcome upon his release. Israel also revoked the VIP cards of three senior Palestinian officials for paying a visit to this freed inmate. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Mona Kandel, joining us live from Ramallah, and also Mahmer Abu Sada, professor of political science at the Al-Azhar University of Gaza City. Thank you very much to both of you for joining us. Now, let's begin with our correspondent, Mona. Could you please shed more light on the different aspects of this type of taking away the passes of Palestinian officials, and what effect does it have?
Well, to make it more clear, the occupied West Bank and West Bank cities are divided. If you want to move from the city of Ramallah to Jenin or to Nablus to Al-Khalil, to any part of the occupied West Bank from a city to another, there are numerous Israeli military checkpoints with Israeli soldiers. They're checking the people. Sometimes they allow people to move freely. Other times, mainly between the big cities, they stop the Palestinian vehicles and they check their IDs. So Palestinian ministers and some senior officials in the Palestinian Authority, let's say, they have VIP pass card. It allows them to move, let's say, more easily inside the occupied West Bank and even around it. Around it means entering Al-Quds and entering the lands that were occupied in 1948. Now the Israeli regime decided to suspend the VIP pass card of Palestinian foreign minister Riyad al-Maliki. Now he's not allowed, let's say, to enter Al-Quds or the lands occupied in 1948, even if the Israelis didn't mention this literally. And his movement inside the occupied West Bank would not be easy. He would be, dealt with as a normal Palestinian citizen. This move has been taken as part of a number of Israeli other moves had been taken by the Israeli regime in response to, a request by the Palestinians on December 31st, the UN General Assembly voted in favor of Palestinian request to seek an advisory opinion from the International Criminal Court on the nature of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories. And this has angered the Israeli regime. Yet we expect more sanctions and punishments would be imposed by the Israeli regime on this Palestinian move.
Okay, so Mona, hold that thought, and I would like you to elaborate more on other measures that the Israeli regime can take in order to basically have a response to that move from the Palestinians. Now, let's bring in Professor Abu Saada. Professor, the measures that we see Israelis are taking, what kind of effect do you think they will have? In practical terms, what does this mean? Revoking the passes of Palestinian officials?
Very good question. Many thanks for having me in this program. And let me start by saying that the new Israeli government, the new right-wing Israeli government, has started its job as a new government by declaring war on the Palestinians in many ways. One, which we saw last week, on Tuesday of last week, the Minister of National Security in Israel stormed Al-Aqsa Mosque, and now the Israeli cabinet has taken some severe measures against the Palestinian leadership, and one of them is the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Riyad al-Maliki, and three other senior Palestinian officials who are member of the Fatah Central Committee and also holding top Palestinian positions. Let me also say that according to the Oslo Agreement, which was signed between Israel and the PLO back in September of 1993, Israel has divided the West Bank into three areas, A, B, and C. And to move from one area to the other area, from A to B or from A to C area, Palestinian officials need, as Mona has indicated, a VIP card, so to facilitate their movement in the occupied West Bank. And by suspending and revoking those VIP cards, those Palestinian officials will not be able to move freely between their place of residence and between their ministries, which are located in the city of Ramallah in the West Bank. But that's not the issue. The issue here is that the Israeli new right-wing government has decided to escalate the situation against the Palestinian leadership to try to put more pressure on the Palestinian leadership to stop its legal battle against Israel in the international community and also at the International Court of Justice, where the Palestinians are seeking justice from the court to issue an advisory resolution with regard to the ongoing Israeli occupation of Palestinian land, which has been going on for more than half a century now, since 1967. It seems to me that we are approaching some severe measures from Israel, which have been declared by the Israeli cabinet 2 days ago, and I believe that will not go without Palestinian retaliation.
Thank you very much. Our correspondent Mona Kandel, live from Ramallah, and also Mahmer Abu Sada, professor of political science from the Al-Azhar University in Gaza City. Thanks to both of you for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. Moving on, Brazil's Supreme Court has suspended the governor of the capital, Brasilia, for 90 days, a day after three government buildings were stormed by supporters of far-right former President Jair Bolsonaro. The Supreme Court cited security flaws that allowed the invasion of the court building, as well as the presidential palace and the Congress. The court also gave Bolsonaro's supporters 24 hours to remove camps. They set up outside military bases. Hundreds of the ex-president's supporters have been arrested in the aftermath of the Sunday attacks. Bolsonaro has condemned the attack, but he is being blamed for triggering it by disputing the outcome of the October presidential elections, which he lost to Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. The incumbent now says that those who invaded the government buildings are fanatical fascists. Lula, who took office just over a week ago, declared a federal security intervention to restore law and order in the capital. The raid on the government buildings has drawn a chorus of condemnations from world leaders, including from several South American countries, the UK, Germany, as well as China. And a report shows well over 70% of German companies believe that the outlook for business is bleak for 2023. The survey by the German Economic Institute indicates that 4 out of 10 firms expect their business to decline this year. That amid high energy costs, supply chain issues, and the continuing war in Ukraine. The survey also shows around a third of the companies expect output to stagnate. The findings also show the risk of gas shortage, which remains high, and production disruptions that cannot be ruled out. The International Monetary Fund has also forecast the German economy to shrink by 0.3% next year, mainly due to the halt of gas flow from Russia amid the war in Ukraine.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If you strive in the cause of God, victory will definitely follow. The following is a part of the speech delivered on June 28, 2022, by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the head of the judiciary branch and a number of top officials and employees of the judiciary.
The judiciary should use expert opinions. Whether this is in the public force, in the Ministry of Intelligence, or elsewhere, the officers who are present sometimes have professional expert opinions. Pay attention to their opinions. Another issue is something that the officers often complain to us about. For example, they say that when they object that why hasn't a certain matter been dealt with, they're told that matter has been dealt with. They're told, we gave it to the judiciary and the judiciary did not do anything. So they ask the judiciary why they haven't done anything. They are told that a law about this case doesn't exist. But if you do not have a law about this matter, who should write that law? You must write it. Make a bill. Write it, give it to the parliament to approve it for you. This should not happen that an officer struggles, makes an effort, does something, and then he comes to the judiciary and is ignored by them due to the negligence of the judiciary or a lack of expertise on the part of the judge in the particular case. In such a situation, his effort will be wasted. So this is the sixth point.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
A comprehensive approach of the relationship between the judiciary and the officers is needed. The seventh point I would like to make is the issue of the psychological security of the people. This is a right of the people that I said I would talk about. The people have a right to psychological security. What does psychological security mean? It means every day a rumor, a lie, or a frightening statement should not be spread to people's mind. Only newspapers were doing such things until yesterday. Now the internet is doing this too. Once in a while, every few days, or sometimes every few hours, a rumor, a lie, or something bad is said by a specific person or an unknown person, and this is published in the internet. These statements worry people and ruin their minds. Some people tell a lie, or they spread a rumor. Well, the people will no longer have psychological security in such a situation. One of the duties of the judiciary is to deal with these instances. Of course, I have heard people say that we do not have a law about this. First of all, the existing laws can be used for this, and based on these laws, the related ruling can be reached.
That you've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Sheikh Abdulaziz bin Zayed's recent trip to Damascus was the second time he met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad as the two Arab nations continued to warm up to each other. The two top diplomats discussed restoration of relations and boosting of economic ties, with Assad saying that they will help regional stability and Sheikh Abdullah expressing support for a diplomatic solution to the conflict in Syria, as he was joined by a group of economic and security officials on his visit. Relations between Syria and the UAE were severed after Syria was expelled from the 22-member Arab League all the way back in 2011. The UAE reopened its embassy in Syria in 2018. Bahrain, Algeria, and Jordan have also resumed ties with Syria, while other Arab nations are calling for Syria's reinstation to the Arab League. This trend has not been sitting well with the U.S., as officials have slammed the visit by Sheikh Abdullah. One U.S. senator has even threatened the UAE with sanctions in a tweet in typical Twitter fashion. UAE's outreach to the Assad regime provides little benefits to the Emirates. This carries huge risks to UAE's reputation, exposes it to Caesar sanctions, and hurts efforts to seek accountability for Assad's crimes against the Syrian people. The Caesar sanctions refers to the Caesar Syria Civilian Protection Act of 2019, also known as the Caesar Act. It is a U.S. legislation that not only sanctions the Syrian government, but also any entity, organization, or individual that provides funding or assistance to it. Iranian and Russian entities have been sanctioned under this act. It follows a pattern in U.S.'s attitude towards its foreign relations. If they don't want to conduct business with a country, no other country should be allowed to either. Sheikh Abdulaziz had criticized the Caesar Act back in 2021 during a meeting with his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. He said, "Bigger challenge today facing coordination and working with Syria is the Caesar Act," and further added, "To keep the Caesar Act as it is today makes this path very difficult, not only for us as a nation, but also for the private sector." To those comments, the U.S. replied that it would not ease up on its stances towards Syria, a stance they have maintained to this day, as apparent by their latest remarks surrounding the latest meeting between Turkish and Syrian officials. In the first time that Ankara and Damascus held talks among their high-ranking officials since 2012, defense ministers of both countries met in Moscow at the end of December. In that meeting, Turkish Foreign Minister Mevlut Çavuşoğlu said that he expects to meet with his Syrian and Russian counterpart later this month. This is a significant shift in Turkey's attitude towards Syria, as Ankara severed ties with the Arab nation back in 2012. And this shift has been met with a swift response from the U.S. When asked about the issue by reporters, Department of State spokesman Ned Price said, "We've made very clear to all of our allies and partners that now is not the time to normalize relations. Now is not the time to upgrade relations. Instead, in the eyes of the U.S., now is the time to impose further crippling sanctions on Syria, where the humanitarian conditions are deteriorating day by day, as the sanctions also include medicinal supplies." A UN special rapporteur on the negative impacts of unilateral coercive measures visited Syria and said that the sanctions have had catastrophic effects on the lives of Syrians as the country grapples with food and medicine shortages. She also said, "In the current dramatic and still deteriorating humanitarian situation, as 12 million Syrians grapple with food insecurity, I urge the immediate lifting of all unilateral sanctions that severely harm human rights and prevent any efforts for early recovery, rebuilding, and reconstruction." Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Thursday that he may meet his Syrian counterpart as part of a new peace process in the wake of the country's defense ministers' meeting. An Erdogan-Assad meeting will signal the official failure of U.S. attempts to topple the Syrian government through sanctions and boycotts, as it will show that U.S. allies are no longer listening to the will of America. It will cause embarrassment for the U.S., not quite on the level of their exodus in Afghanistan, but not too far off either.
The head of the International Monetary Fund, Kristalina Georgieva, has issued a dire warning over the economic outlook in 2023, saying that this year is going to be even tougher than the year 2022. That is because the U.S., EU, and Chinese economies have slowed down. The Ukraine conflict, soaring prices, and hiked interest rates, and the rise of the COVID have contributed to the slowdown in the global economy. She also said that a third of the world economy will be hit by a recession in 2023.
For most of the world economy, this is going to be a tough year, tougher than the year we leave behind. Why? Because the three big economies, US, EU, China, are all slowing down simultaneously. Half of the European Union will be in recession next year. China is going to slow down this year further. Next year would be a tough year for China. Mm-hmm. And that translates into negative trends globally.
Back in October, the IMF slashed its outlook for global economic growth in 2023. It blamed the gloomy outlook on the ongoing conflict in Ukraine and tougher monetary policies. According to Georgieva, China will face a very difficult start to the year 2023. That's because it is likely to grow at or below global growth for the first time in 40 years, she said.
China has slowed down dramatically in 2020. Two, because of this tight zero COVID policy. For the first time in 40 years, China's growth in 2022 is likely to be at or below global growth. That has never happened before. And looking into next year, for 3, 4, 5, 6 months, the relaxation of COVID restrictions would mean bushfire COVID cases throughout China.
She also said that the U.S. economy may avoid a recession, but warned a strong labor market there may lead the U.S. Federal Reserve to keep interest rates tight so as to combat high inflation, which could have negative economic consequences of its own. The IMF warning comes amid similar predictions by other institutions. UK-based Center for Economics and Business Research has said that the global slide into a recession next year, as a number of economies will contract due to surging borrowing costs introduced to combat inflation. K. Daniel Neufeld said, "We expect central bankers to stick to their guns in 2023, despite the economic costs. The cost of bringing inflation down to more comfortable levels is a poorer growth outlook for a number of years to come." The report is more pessimistic than the most recent forecast by the International Monetary Fund. Meanwhile, oil prices continue to slide, weighed down by China's rising COVID cases and a recession warning from the IMF. The warning comes amid a worsening economic crisis in developed nations. Just recently, Germany's Federal Statistical Office said that the country is grappling with its highest annual inflation in more than 70 years. According to official data, full-year inflation reached 7.9% in 2022 amid surging energy and food prices. The last time annual inflation was near that level was in the year 1951, when it stood at 7.6% as the post-war economic boom began. And the UK faces one of the worst recessions among the world's leading industrialized nations this year.
We're not the government. We haven't been in power for 12 years. Right, every aspect of society that's been impacted by government policy. 10 years of austerity, cuts to the economy, slowing growth, a badly handled Brexit, whatever your view on Brexit was, right, has all led to where we are today. But the fact that we've got so many people out on strike and so many people suffering, only the government can change it, or a change of government can change it.
The fallout from spiraling inflation triggered by the pandemic and the Ukraine conflict will persist for longer in the UK than in other G7 nations, and the country's recovery will be one of the weakest. In November 2022, the Republican Party won the majority of votes in the House of Representatives. They vowed to go after Democrats and President Joe Biden, but now cracks have appeared with the party itself. In a historic incident, the GOP failed to nominate the House Speaker. Party leader Kevin McCarthy got just 203 votes in two rounds, less even than Democrat Hakeem Jeffries in the GOP-controlled chamber, and fared even worse, with 202 votes in round three. It went to six rounds, but yet McCarthy could not gain the votes. It was a tumultuous start to the new Congress and pointed to a difficult road ahead with Republicans now in control of the House. A new generation of conservative Republicans, many aligned with Donald Trump's Make America Great Again agenda, want to upend business as usual in Washington and were committed to stopping McCarthy's rise without concessions to their priorities. It is widely believed that a revolt of ultra-hardliners has dealt a humiliation to McCarthy.
Those of us who will not be voting for Kevin McCarthy today take no joy in this discomfort that this moment has brought. But if you want to drain the swamp, you cannot put the biggest alligator in charge of the exercise.
McCarthy became the first candidate to fall short in a first ballot for Speaker in a century. The impasse means Republicans are unable even to assume the control that they won in the midterms, as the new House can't yet be sworn in. The standoff over McCarthy has been building since Republicans appeared on track to win the House majority in the midterm elections in November. A new generation of Trump-aligned Republicans led the opposition to McCarthy, believing that he's neither conservative enough nor tough enough to battle Democrats.
And they even came to the position where one, Matt Gaetz, said, "I don't care if we go to plurality and we elect Hakeem Jeffries and it hurts the new frontline members not to get reelected." Well, that's not about America, and I will always fight to put the American people first, not a few individuals that want something for themselves. So we may have a battle on the floor, but the battle is for the conference and the country, and that's fine with me.
While the Senate remains in Democratic hands, House Republicans are eager to confront Biden after 2 years of the Democrats controlling both houses of Congress. But disagreements to choose the House Speaker is an ominous sign for the party and its conservative agenda. Even if McCarthy succeeds to be the Speaker, he will be a weak figure who may be in office but barely in power. The war, which started with the Tea Party backlash to the Obama administration, is far from over.
We will compromise, but we will not capitulate. And there's a very serious difference. There's 222 Republicans in our conference now. So if 20 people are able to drive this train however they want to, 202 of us might as well go home, because that means they are the conference. That means they those 20 people will be the majority. Well, that is capitulation, and we will not do that. Compromise, yes.
The fractured support for McCarthy is over the direction of the GOP between swing district moderates and conservatives who have taken up the populist agenda of the former President Donald Trump. It is now believed that the chaos highlights the dilemma facing House Republicans.
You have 20 people demanding that 201 surrender to them unconditionally. Well, I will not surrender unconditionally. If you have conditions, give them to us. We'll consider them. Doesn't mean we'll do them, but you have to talk about them. But we've asked and we've asked, what is it you want? What do you need? But you have 20 people demanding the unconditional surrender of, including this group of warriors. We will not unconditionally surrender. Tell us what you want. We might surrender if you tell us the terms.
Analysts say no matter the concessions made to some of those on the far right, they simply will not relent and join other Republicans. The crisis is even more poignant as the party is set to brace for the presidential election set to be held in 2024. It now appears the fractures that Trump created within the Republican Party are deeper than ever before. With Trump still desperate to be elected president, it is unlikely the GOP will be able to unite behind another leader and change its electoral fortunes anytime soon. It didn't take more than a day after the most controversial and right-wing cabinet took over in Israel, headed by Benjamin Netanyahu. The UNGA acted swiftly and asked the ICJ to consider the consequences for Israel over its occupation of Palestinian territories.
Israeli practices and settlement activities affecting the rights of the Palestinian people and other Arabs of the occupied territories. End of quote.
It appeared as though the timing was pre-planned, and that the resolution was a signal to the new administration. Lots of cheers from PA Ambassador to the UN on the matter, though.
This vote and request comes one day after the new Israeli government was formed, pledging to accelerate colonial and racist policies against the Palestinian people.
It came as no surprise that the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu had the complete opposite view, saying that Israel is not bound by the UN vote. But does this resolution and referral to the ICJ even make a difference where Israel is concerned, or Palestinians for that matter? Definitely not. The reasons speak for themselves. As far as the ICC is concerned, Israel is not a party to the Rome Statute that established the ICC. This is while the International Criminal Court has determined that it does have jurisdiction over the territories occupied by Israel, despite Israel's insistence to the contrary. So what is the point of all of this if it won't change the facts on the ground? Well, aside from Israel not being a member of the ICC, it disputes its jurisdiction on the basis that Palestine is not a sovereign state that is capable of being a party to the Rome Statute. The UNGA areas of focus have been issues that Israel has not heeded, nor has it even taken into account. Violation by Israel on the rights of the Palestinian people to self-determination, as well as altering the demographic composition of Al-Quds, is something that Israel has been actively doing. Not only that, coming right out of the gates, this administration has already said that it will go against the resolution. When it comes to the UN, Israel has had the most UN resolutions slapped against it, over 70 and counting. Israel has followed none. The Israeli ambassador, Gilad Erdan, has called the resolution moral stain on the UN. He said no international body can decide that the Jewish people are occupiers in their own homeland, adding any decision from a judicial body which receives its mandate from the morally bankrupt and politicized UN is completely illegitimate. The UNGA resolution also exposes the hypocrisy of the so-called normalization of some Persian Gulf Arab countries with Israel. The resolution had virtually unanimous support from the Islamic world, including Arab states that have normalized relations with Israel.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is the show A to Z. For today's program, Brother Muhammad is going to talk to us about Islamic education. Stay tuned.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Dear listeners, welcome to IRIB English Radio with A to Z. In today's discussion with regards to Islamic education, we would like to look at an important aspect of the Muslim identity. A Muslim is an obedient servant of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And the most important aspect of being a Muslim is worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. One of those best and most important acts of worship in the life of a Muslim is to pray salah. And when it comes to Islamic nurturing of salah, how do we go about nurturing and educating our children with regards to salah? This is an important question. And indeed, our ma'asumeen, the holy progeny of the holy infallibles, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon them, have instructed us on ways and methods to implement salah in our own lives and also to inculcate salah in the lives of our children. One of those strategies that have been taught to us is verbal reminders and creating awareness verbally. One of those methods that have been asked by the Ma'asumeen alayhi wasalam for us to remind our children is to take salah seriously by standing firm in salah, by standing erect and not moving and not playing around with the body parts. As we have a hadith, a tradition from Imam Ali alayhi salam, that he once was with the Prophet and he saw the Prophet watching a person praying salah while that person was playing with his beard. And Rasulullah said, if this person had the presence of the heart and his attention was with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, he would not have been playing with his beard and his limbs would have been humble and stationary likewise. Indeed, it's very important for us to also remind our children to begin praying without any distractions with stillness in the body and to focus on what is being recited. On the other hand, we're also told that once we are preparing to enter the state of salah, we should not enter it in a state of laziness, in a state that our body is not cooperating with us by being very tired or being very sleepy. And all of these, according to a hadith from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, are considered to be the signs of hypocrisy. As the Quran also says that the munafiqun are those when they stand for salah, qamu kusala, they stand in a state of laziness, tiredness. They do not allow their salah to be such that will allow them to connect with Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Rather, they are constantly waiting for salah to end. They treat salah very indifferently, and they are just hoping and wishing that when salat will come to an end. So indeed, these are things that need to be taken into account as we pray salah ourselves. And also when we inculcate this salah and educate our children with regards to salah, we need to constantly be on the lookout for these aspects of salah. Through verbal reminders, inshallah ta'ala, we shall be able to inculcate these aspects into our children's lives. I hope you enjoy today's discussion. Until next time, fi amanillah, under God's protection.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, communities, and most importantly, the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, and we shall also look at, in the backdrop of tumultuous Sino-India relations and border tensions, China's recent interest in rebooting relations with India. We will discuss BJP government in New Delhi formalizing new rules to change the demography of the Muslim-majority state of Jammu and Kashmir.
Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi recently stated that Beijing is willing to work with India to improve bilateral ties, extending an olive branch to the regional foe. His remarks suggest China wants to reset its ties with India. Wang's Indian counterpart, on the other hand, has maintained that the status of the relationship between the two countries will depend on the state of the border. S.J. Shankar noted that relations between the two sides are going through a difficult phase.
India-China relations continue to remain at odds. India's Foreign Minister S.J. Shankar has on many occasions mentioned the state of problematic relations between the two countries. He believes that the two countries need mutual sensitivity, mutual respect, and mutual interest to restore normal diplomatic ties. His Chinese counterpart, on the other hand, looks more optimistic and has offered to open a new chapter in bilateral ties. Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi earlier this week said that both countries have maintained communication through diplomatic and military channels, and both are committed to upholding the stability in the disputed border region. He expressed China's desire to work with India in the direction towards steady and sound growth of China-India relations. The statement came amid heightened tensions after paramilitary forces of the two countries clashed near Tawang in the northeastern Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh last month. Even though the situation was brought under control, the truth is that after the Galwan clash in 2020, the forces of the two countries show no sign of pulling back. It remains to be seen if the Chinese foreign minister's statement will change anything on the ground or if the status quo will remain intact.
The India-China border clashes in recent years have been the worst in over half a century, bringing the relationship between the two countries to an all-time low. While India is working to deepen its cooperation with the U.S., Beijing is hoping New Delhi might retrace its old antipathy towards the West and abstain from moving closer to the U.S. in particular. China has maintained that it will not be subdued by hegemonic powers and their bullying tactics, calling on New Delhi to join the Eastern Bloc.
Sino-India relations have hit the rock bottom in the last few years. The two Asian giants have been involved in military skirmishes along the disputed borders in Ladakh and Arunachal Pradesh on several occasions. More recently, a video emerged online of what appeared to be a previously unreported violent clash between the two armies. The video was reportedly filmed in the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh at the line of actual control, the de facto border between the two countries. The growing India-U.S. bonhomie has not also been taken well by China. In a recent speech by the Chinese foreign minister while taking stock of China's foreign policy during the year 2022, he primarily focused on China's troubled relationship with the U.S. Wang Yi, while lashing out at the U.S., pointed to its relations with China as erroneous policy. China has also not been happy with India's membership in the U.S.-led quadrilateral security dialogue. The Quad, compromising the U.S., India, Japan and Australia, often referred to as Asian NATO, is aimed at thwarting the Chinese plans for the Asia-Pacific region. China has maintained that it is focusing on strategic stability in relation to other major countries to make the world a better place.
Now, to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Chris McRain from Manchester. He's a geopolitical analyst. Mr. McRain, welcome to the program. Now, let's begin with China's recent statement to work with India for better relations between the two countries. How do you see it, especially coming at a time when the two sides recently engaged in clashes near the Indian state of Arunachal Pradesh?
I think China's main goal, as it has been for the past 30 years of development, is the progress of a multipolar world. And India is a big part of that. I know they do have a disagreement of a dispute over territory around that area. I know there are treaties in place that stop weapons being used in that area. If you see troop movements in that area, they almost look like medieval armies because they're all carrying melee weapons rather than ballistic weapons. There's no guns. So they are making some sort of steps to make peace. But a lot of this is about economic development, which is a big part of it. Obviously, one of the main adversaries in the world as it is today is almost putting the brakes on American interference. So China showing that sort of hand of friendship in aiding co-opting the Indian development together is a really big, important step, I think, and it shows a lot of maturity in the Chinese position.
Mr. McRain, how do you look at India's policy regarding China? Are there any takers for cordial China-India relations in India, or India wants to focus on getting closer to the West, especially the U.S. seeing China as an arch rival in the region?
I think the American position very much wants it to be an arch rival. America have been courting the government of Modi for quite some time in the hope of it being some sort of bulwark against Chinese development. You do see sometimes where it does look like it could go that way and then it somehow tethers the other. I personally